Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Fighting Words on Fighting Words News Network. Fighting Words is brought to you each and every week. Day of the week, grateful appreciation to the men and women of police and fire services and men and women of the United States Armed Forces by Dr. Kathleen Carroll, a board-certified psychiatrist in private practice since 2003. Dr. Carroll previously was the director of inpatient services at the Bay Pines VA Hospital and the Bay Pines VA Medical Center. Dr. Carroll specializes in the treatment of children ages 6 and older and the treatment of adults, in other words, from the room to the tomb. She's also an all-time triathlete, so if you're having any problems breaking through to the next level of sports, give her a call. She'd be able to help you out. Her phone number is 813-689-2466. Her office is located at 336 East Bloomingdale Avenue in Brandon, Florida. Well, guys, it's... it was going to be the highlight of the year. It may still be. But our special guest is training. I just got an email from his administrative assistant. She's going to try and get to him and give us 10 minutes, and I'm going to keep calling back. But
I tell you what. First of all, how's it going, Butch and Vito? How are you guys doing today?
Doing great.
I'm well.
And I will say this, as far as our show goes, we have had another highlight of the year thus far. A good friend of the show, one Tony Thompson, went over to Turkey to have his rematch with a split decision victory over Lander Solis. And he actually ended up stopping Solis in the ninth round. Solis didn't come out for the ninth round. Vito, I thought I'd let you know, Solis came to the ring weighing 272 pounds.
Wasn't that something?
And to be honest, you almost expect that now from Solis. I mean, all the talent and all the skill he has in the world, his conditioning, it holds it all back. He could do it for maybe a round or two, but, I mean, that 270,
Tony's not the level of fighter that you can ill prepare for. And 272, at least from a cardiovascular standpoint, is ill prepared. To go 12 or 10 with Tony. So, again, like you said, wasted talent to a certain extent because he never showed the dedication that would get him to ascend the mountain in the pros.
And that goes to show you, Solis is underachieving. And to be honest, you could say he's overachieving.
Exactly. With Tony, you're talking about a guy who came to the sport late. He's, what, 44 now? And 43 now? Yeah, 43 came to the sport late. And he's just had another big win that keeps him relevant in the relatively thin heavyweight division. There are a lot of good fights out there. And Tony's kind of become the guy that separates the wheat from the chaff. If you beat Tony, then you know what? You're good enough to at least challenge a Klitschko. If you don't beat Tony, then you know there might be some other options on the table that you might want to assess.
And Tony's an avoided guy, too. I mean, he is one of the top heavyweights out there. And you don't see many guys lining up in his direction. Tony's a tough out if he's going to even be an out.
Agreed. I completely agreed.
Yeah, he did you see a picture of him in online with Fight News? Tony looks.
I did not.
Yeah, he looks like he's in the best shape I've ever seen him. Yeah,
I know he looked like he didn't weigh 272.
Tony's looks can be deceiving because you can see him come to the ring with love handles and everything, but he's always prepared to fight 12.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, that's true. I've never seen Tony gas. And you know what? That second fight with David Price, the second knockout of Price, was a much more gritty affair, and I've never seen Tony gas. In fact, it seemed like Tony was the one who was pulling the younger man in the deeper waters, and it looked like David Price's conditioning was betraying him a little bit. Tony looked like the fresher guy heading towards the back end of that fight before he pulled the switch on Price.
Looking more experienced guy. He knew where to go at on Price. He knew that the taller, and Tony doesn't find many taller fighters, but the taller guy, you know, he went to his body. He jabbed up top, got his guard up high, and Tony went to the body. And essentially, by the time he knocked Price out, Price, he didn't want any more.
You would also think, with Tony being kind of like a top 10, you know, fringe 10 contender, obviously he's had two shots at Klitschko, so, you know, it's going to be a while before he can get another shot at Vladimir. He'd have to go for that Wilder's belt. But you would think, at his quality, a lot of opponents will look at him and be like, you know what, this be a good preparatory match for me before I fight a Klitschko. Even though Tony's a southpaw, Tony's a tall guy, he works behind the jab, he doesn't have Klitschko's power, but it'd be a good preparatory match. But I think what happens is Tony's too risky a match for some fighters. So.
Yeah, Tony's not a guy that you can look good against, unless you're basically a Klitschko. He has too many things he could do in the ring. And his size does pose a problem.
I would have loved to have seen Brian Jennings fight at Tony Thompson before heading into that Klitschko fight there.
Yeah, before Klitschko, but I wouldn't suggest Tony Thompson before maybe two, three other fights for Brian Jennings.
Exactly. I agree. give
yeah, the funny thing
on
is
Nicholas
that Tony, like we said, Tony's 43. Solis was only is only 34, and he just ran out of gas. He just flat ran out of gas.
272. I guess he trained for the fight by eating at a buffet. 272 is too heavy. He's a 6'2", maybe,
yeah,
guy. You know, with Tony's height, Tony's not weighing in at 272. And the other thing, too, is even when Tony's hasn't been in, you know, the best shape as far as weight, I remember he came in for the one of the David Price fights heavier than usual. But like Zito said, he's so relaxed in the ring. And he's very economical with what he does. He's economical with his movement. He's economical with his punches, and so he's not a guy who is forced or allows himself to be dragged into a hard paced fight. And so you know, he's a guy, like Zito said, his looks can betray him. He could look soft and completely be ready to go 12 rounds. Orlando Solis is not that same caliber of athlete. He's a different type of athlete. He's an athlete who needs to be trimmed and who needs to be primed and ready. Not that he's not as relaxed as Tony, but he's a different type of fighter. And he does not, and he has not for the past years, given himself the best chance to make a name for himself in the heavyweight division.
And that's a shame. That's absolutely a shame, just because he has all of the talent to be one of the top heavyweights. He absolutely has the talent to challenge at least a Klitschko, to make it a fight. But, I mean, determination is not there in camp to even get in shape. So what's it going to be in the ring?
Right. And the fight will stop between the stools. So, you know, you talk about determination, will to win. Obviously, he was at a position where he didn't feel like coming out for the next round, or his corner said, you know what, that's about it for you. You're obviously, he probably was at a point where he's having a hard time even catching wind. So, again, that, you know, this could be the end of the road for a very talented fighter who never quite took advantage of his gifts.
Doesn't have the wind to win.
Wow. And what's next for Tony? Where does Tony go? I mean, obviously options abound, but who's going to fight him? Can he get a fight in the States, or is he going to have to continue to fight in Europe and Turkey and Asia and places, you think?
Well, that's where he makes his money, because apparently the top heavyweights in the States are going to avoid Tony. I mean, I wish they wouldn't, but, I mean, that's the fact of the matter. The guy's too good for anybody. He's not, as I said before, it's hard to look good against him.
Right.
There's too much, risk, too little reward.
I guess, the WBA has now ordered Frotch and Ward for their mandatory. What do you think about that one?
Well, you know, sanctioning bodies do what sanctioning bodies do, which is why they get the respect that they get amongst the sport today. With that being said, that's a fight that's not going to happen. Obviously, Andre Ward has been out the ring for over a year. He said he needs a couple fights to get his groove back before he's ready to start, you know, taking on that top elite level competition. He stated that himself. So that's a fight that's obviously not going to be made within the next 100-some-odd days. No one's worried about being stripped because, right now the guys have the status and the cachet they have. Carl Froch at this point is only looking for a big fight, and he's not looking Andre Ward's way. That's a tough fight for him. He's already lost to Andre Ward convincingly. So that's a tough fight for him that doesn't bring a lot of money. He's looking for, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., at the MGM Grand. He's looking for a big fight, maybe even a Bernard Hopkins in Vegas. So I don't think he's looking Andre Ward's way, but at the same time, at this point in time, Andre Ward's not looking his way either. So I don't think either one will really care about what happens to that belt at this point.
Yeah, that's understandable. Carl Froch, he deserves a big money fight. I mean, he's been at the top of his weight class for a while. I mean, and Andre Ward, he does need to get his feet up under him. He's been out of boxing for a while. And, I mean, it's you don't want to just jump in the face of a guy like Carl Froch.
No, especially a guy who's been active like Carl Froch, too. You know, Andre Ward hasn't been active since the Super 6 ended. Since they're fighting the Super 6, Andre Ward's had, like, two fights, and Carl Froch has had, like, five. So, I mean, there's a different level of activity going on. So, yeah, again, it makes sense, both of them. Their reasoning for looking the other way makes perfect sense right now. Speaking of super middleweights in the middleweight division, Zito, what did you think about one Gennady Golovkin last week?
Well, he looked like Gennady Golovkin. I mean, there's nothing in that fight that told me a whole lot that was different from him. Martin Murray showed me that he was tough and that he had a little more tricks in the bag than I thought he did. He tried his jab all right at times. He plays very good body shots on Golovkin that throws Golovkin up a few times. But Golovkin never ceased his steady pressure, and Martin Murray just couldn't avoid the shots. And eventually, you know, the ref stopped it. Martin Murray took too much punishment. And I actually was talking to the TV calling for a stoppage two rounds before, earlier.
You know what the interesting thing is after the fight, when asked, Martin Murray said it wasn't Golovkin's power that troubled him. He said he hits hard, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't his trouble that troubled him. It was his pressure that really was troubling him. Golovkin was always in his face, not giving him a chance to set, reset, not giving him a chance to breathe, to work with the space and the distance he wanted to work. That's one thing I noticed, too. Is I've seen Golovkin fight several times, as you know, many of us have now, and in this particular fight, he's always a very steady, kind of methodical pressure fighter. But in this fight, he looked much more relentless. Did you see that, did he not look any more relentless to you? To me, he looked like he was a little bit more relentless, and I think it was part of the equation was that Martin Murray didn't have the punching power to really dent him.
Well, to a point, he looked like the regular Golovkin, just because, I mean. The really only fight I saw him take a little bit of a pause to power was with Curtis Stevens. But everybody else he faced, he's basically done the same thing. One thing you stated while he was fighting, and you said you liked it, was the way Golovkin, he didn't, as a pressure fighter, he has very educated feet. And he didn't smother himself. And as you were stating during the fight, he would take that step back. To not, you know, when he had Martin Murray in the corner and he would maybe feel he got a little close, he would take a step back, get basically in better punching range and, you know, more effective to himself punching range, and he would basically bomb on Martin Murray. Martin Murray, he's not defensively slick, so he really couldn't avoid lot. Offense, he tries to add diversity to his offense, but Martin Murray is not the most diversified offensive guy. And as you stated, he doesn't have that power for Golovkin to respect. But the body shots were powerful, and Golovkin did respect those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You know, I agree, too. And I think what separates Golovkin from some of the other renowned power punchers in the sport, the guys like Lucas Matisse or even Sergey Kovalev or Ruslan Provitnikov, I think the biggest difference between he and these guys is his balance. He's always in position to punch. And where the other guys, I see them off balance, I see them square up a lot. Not, you know, punchers tend to square up, but I see these guys throw punches in their constantly off balance, feet come together. That doesn't happen with Golovkin. He's always in a position to punch or defend. I don't think he's the best defensive fighter. Part of that could be his offensive mentality. Part of that could be because as a puncher he tends to square up. I don't think he's a great defensive fighter. But at the same time, like I said, I've never seen him out of punching position. He's always in a position to punch, which makes him very dangerous.
And one thing is, Golovkin, he does not have fast feet at all. He doesn't burst with his feet at all. But for a guy with slow feet, he's really effective at not letting fighters get away. I mean,
yeah, I think he's really good at cutting off the ring. His feet are really educated.
And he keeps the ring cut off for a bit. I mean, you'll see a guy try to, you know, slide to the right, he'll slide to his left.
You know what the funny thing is, too, Zito, is when we talk about footwork, You know, people tend to look at, well, Muhammad Ali had great footwork. Well, yeah, duh. But a footwork is not always the bouncing boxer. Golovkin has tremendous footwork. He just has the footwork of a puncher. He doesn't have a footwork of a slickster or a speedster, but he has tremendous footwork. He knows how to set up angles, how to cut off the ring on his opponents, and he knows how to close distance, and he knows how to pull away and gain distance when he feels he's being grabbed or smothered. Very educated feet, and I think, to me, that's what separates him from the other punchers. It isn't that he hits harder or anything to do with his combinations even. To me, it's his feet. He's always in a position to throw a killer punch.
And he places his punch well. Places his punches very, very well.
Yeah.
He could go to the head and body equally.
Yeah, a guy used to punch a lot to the head with Tommy Morrison, and now I see that his son is now taking up his his stay. He's 6-0 and got a fight coming up next week. Oh, no, it's tomorrow. Yeah, next Saturday in Oklahoma against Richard Dawson.
Yeah, yeah. Tommy Morrison's son's been going at it. You know, obviously we wish the kid luck. His dad was hell on wheels to see, win or lose. I never forget the fight with he and Ray Mercer. That was probably one of the most brutal knockouts I've ever seen, especially for the victim of the knockout to come out like gangbusters and really rip into Ray Mercer. But Ray Mercer had a legendary chin, and Tommy Morrison, unfortunately, did not. And that was the difference in that fight. But Tommy Morrison, he accomplished a lot in a short time. Remember, he came up the top man circuit, so he didn't have this tremendous amateur background. And, he was pretty successful. And he was at a pretty exciting time during that heavyweight era of the 90s. He was a major cog during that.
And Tommy Morrison, people forget, Tommy Morrison outboxed George Foreman.
Yes, he did.
I mean, and granted, George Foreman wasn't the fastest guy. George Foreman was smarter in his older years. And as you said, Tommy Morrison came up in the tough guy circuit. For him to outbox George Foreman, who was the ex-heavyweight champion, that's tremendous.
Yeah. And this was George Foreman before he went on to beat Mike Tomlin. So, I mean, yeah. So he was even younger than he was when he won the title again. So, kudos to Tommy
Morrison.
He definitely provided some thrilling moments in the ring. And like you said, man, if his son has his hook, then he'll always be dangerous.
Yeah. How about the following week, another one of your favorites, Ty, Chris Areola's fighting on 13th.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Areola, I just read that today, actually, that he's looking to return to the ring, which is good. You always want to see a quality guy continue his career and to make money. But the fact of the matter is that Chris Areola's career now will begin as a gatekeeper. He probably really didn't deserve that title. Either of the all three of the title shots he got, he probably didn't necessarily deserve them from a ranking standpoint, but maybe he deserved them from a popularity standpoint, especially here in the States with the heavyweight division being the way it is. And he was a very charismatic guy. But the fact of the matter is he's fought a top-10 ranked opponent four times, and he's lost all those fights. Ademik, twice to Stavern, and once to Vitaly Klitschko. So he's a guy who could never get over the hump, and all of a sudden we look up and Chris Areola's 34. So he's not, anymore that young 29, 28-year-old brash, Mexican guy who wants to be this first Mexican heavyweight champion. Now all of a sudden he's a 34-year-old man who's settled down, he's matured a lot, and he's, found maturity in the ring. But I think what has happened is the weight was hiding something that, a lot of boxing people already knew, that he was really not a great fighter. He was a very solid fighter, and that even with the weight off, he still wouldn't be a great fighter. And I think that's what we're seeing. But you definitely want to wish him luck because he's been a great guy and, great for the sport.
I'll tell you what, going and coming, Chris Areola is an entertaining guy. In the ring,
sir.
Interviews. I always liked seeing Chris Areola on TV. I think what happened with Chris Areola was right when he was peaking and his skills were getting better, he concentrated on physicality and strength. He concentrated on offensive bursts. offensive, you know, push instead of actual technical skill, because I honestly think he degraded skill-wise.
I agree.
He used to be a guy who would move his head, his guard up, and he actually counterpunched. He had a pretty good jab to get inside. He would go to the body. It seemed like he got big, and after that Klitschko fight, he just started rushing guys, pushing punches, keeping his head stiff. I mean, it seemed like...
You know, I think you make a very astute point. I think that's a very astute point, because I think, for me, when I look at Chris Areola, he was always the same defensively. He always had the same holes, the same lashes. But I think you're right. It seemed like he put his offense together much better than he had been in later years. You know, he put his offense together much better than he had been. He was always open for a right, always open, you know, he was always open for shots. That was just a part of him. But you know, I think you're right. His offense seemed to have degraded specifically to me, which obviously has made his defense much more vulnerable too.
Yeah,
and gentlemen, we're joined by the man who is faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to jump small women with one bound.
You got it backwards. Able to jump over tall bras in a single bound.
Wow.
How you single women, huh? Oh, God. How you guys doing?
Hey, good. Dr. Chris, how you doing?
Well, I got my phone fixed by so many experts that they put the voice up. They got it on speaker for me so I could hear, and then they put it on silent somehow, so I couldn't hear it. I had to go get my wife to fix it. Yeah, I'm doing fine, guys. I've enjoyed some fights this week. I saw a lot of reruns, and. I fell asleep last night. It came on at 2 in the morning, but there was a fight between a guy from Detroit, 140-pound division, and the Mexican that's undefeated. He's a 140-pounder. He's 16-0. Mm. But he was having a tough time with this kid. You know who it is?
I'm trying to think. Yeah. Don't know.
His name's going to come to me soon. I turned in after like the first or second round by the time I got it on. But anyway, guys, there's some good fights coming up. Boy, they're very enjoyable. I liked Golovkin the other night.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, what did you think of Golovkin in that fight?
Well, you know what impressed me? He does a lot of touch punching, like. He'll go 1, 2, 3, just touch. And then, boom, the fourth punch of the combination will be a knockout punch. He just sets you up. He gets off first so you don't get off. And then he loads up on that fourth after he kind of gets in position. Not too many guys that do that. Mayweather can touch punch. Just tap, 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 boom.
Yeah,
you know?
Good example.
I really like that in a fighter. And that impressed me. He's always got the great body punch and the power. But when a guy had a good defense, he kept throwing just to keep him there, you know, right. To keep him covered up. And then if you saw an opening, boom, he let go. I mean, that guy is big and strong for a middleweight. Man,
yeah.
That other guy.
Yeah, Martin Murray. He's a big guy for a middleweight, yeah.
Yeah, these guys are light heavyweights, just dehydration. The junior middleweights look like the old-fashioned middleweights, and the middleweights now look like the old light heavyweights. I said that many times, but every time I turn around, the 160-pounders are getting bigger. You know?
Yep.
So I saw Ali at probably 230, and in 2 weeks, he was fighting at about 218. I never saw a guy get rid of water so fast. You know, he lost
Dr.
about
Chris,
12 pounds, maybe less than 2 weeks.
We were talking about the light heavyweight that gave Ali trouble was Doug Jones. I don't know why that
Doug
came
Jones.
To me hung up. I was like, Doug Jones, yeah.
You know how? Howard Johnson died.
Yep.
And they brought back his being a great local fighter. They said, these are some of the guys he beat. Ezra Charles, he's going on and on. Archie Moore,
He beat Doug Jones.
Doug Jones. That's the guy, Doug Jones.
Yeah.
Gave Ali life or death. And then Howard Johnson shut him out 15-0. It's the only time I ever saw a guy go 15 rounds, didn't even get hit with a jab. He blocked every jab with his right hand. It was an amazing fight. Harold Johnson was an amazing fighter, boxer. He put you to sleep because he was so perfect, and he never was an aggressive fighter because he knew he'd make mistakes if he led first. They could counter him. One time, he was beating Archie Moore. It was a 15-round fight. 12 rounds, he had to have Archie Moore down 10-2. And he made one mistake. One mistake. Archie Moore threw that big right hand. You know how he came in with that Foreman shell defense, you know, with the arms in front of him?
The cross.
He whipped that right hand over, hit Howard Johnson right above the ear, and he went down like a cannon shot. And that's the only mistake I ever saw him make in a ring. But he paid dearly for it.
But Archie could hit hard.
Archie's not a guy you wanted to make mistakes with.
He had big arms.
More knockouts than anyone in history.
Well, he had huge arm and he had a little tiny head. His head's no bigger than a little pineapple. I said, Archie, how the hell did it feel when Marciano hit you in the head? You know, I said, that little head, how the hell did it take Marciano? And Marciano must have hit him 75 times in a row, right on top of the head, on the forehead. Archie, when I saw him, he wouldn't shake hands because he had arthritis in his hands.
Mm.
So I said to him, I kid him, I said, Archie, you got a little head for light heavyweight. I said, Marciano's bombs couldn't have felt too damn good on your head. He said, he didn't. And he was, he was enjoyable to meet. He came to Eastern Pennsylvania at the request of Larry Holmes for his testimonial dinner that he holds once a year, honoring the Catholic Club, and he was the star of his show. He was funny. Oh my God! He didn't try to be, but he just was comical. Everything he did, all the questions he asked him, he would get very annoyed if you asked him a stupid question. Yeah, you know, he would let you know real quick, and he'd get mad if you tried to shake hands with him. Oh, God, because he said, my hands have arthritis. But honest to God, his head can't be any more than a size 6. His little head.
Wow.
The whole time I'm talking to him, all I could think of is in that last round, Marciano hit him 50 times right on the front of the forehead. I don't know how to this day Marciano didn't bust his hands, you know? I have no idea. But I said, Archie, how the hell did you take all them punches with that little head you got? He said, how the hell do you remember that? I said, the whole world saw it. I said, I paid $5 to get in that night. That's what the pay-per-view was. Well, in those days, you went to the movie theater.
Oh, yeah, closed circuit, yeah.
Yeah, he went to the movie theater. I couldn't get in. I tried to sneak in. I couldn't sneak in. I only had $5 in my pocket. So I'm running. Somebody said, the usher opened the door up on the right-hand side. So I'm running, and an arm reaches out and grabs me, pulls me in line, and everybody started screaming, oh, that guy in line, and it was Rocky Jones, who had just beat LaStarza. He got out of line. He said, anybody got any complaints? He goes, everybody shut up. I said, Rock, I feel bad stepping in line in front of all these people. Don't worry about it. He goes, don't worry about it. So he was my buddy. We used to, we worked out in a gym that was at least 150 in there. It was an old tar paper covered garage, hot, no air, no fans, no nothing, no windows. And Rocky said, I want to go swimming. He says, after we got done working out, I used to wrestle with him for half an hour at a time because I was heavy at the time. And we went out to Bridgewater, freshwater. He can't swim worth a damn. I said, Rocky, don't you fall in the water because you'll drown. I said, he would go about 6 feet out from the edge of the bank and then turn around and come back like a dog swimming. Yeah, you go, doggy, that's how he would get back. Then he turned around. He ran up a cliff. I swear to God, the cliff was at a 100, I mean, we're straight up in the air. I thought he was going to kill himself. He ran up this cliff, got up on top, and he said, "I can really get in shape here." I said, "Yeah, if you don't kill yourself, how the hell are you going to get down now? You know, you can't come down." He would have got killed. He was a funny man. But anyway, I remember that most about that fight was Rocky pulled me in line. Like, I was thrilled to see that fight. Of course, it was in black and white in them days, and there was a lot of drama with that fight. Archie Moore threw a sneak right hand. He used to carry his right hand real high and then chop down on it. And when you made a certain move to go underneath of him, he would chop down. He knocked Marciano down in about the third or fourth round. But that was it. That was it. Rocky never tried that again. And he's only down twice in his life. Walcott dropped him.
Yeah.
And Archie Moore dropped him.
Yeah.
Walcott, what a puncher he was.
Dropped
he was
bar.
A powerful man. He was very powerful. He had, you know what, he had great big shoulders and arms, but he was only 5'11". But he had the shoulders, you know, big shoulders for a man of 195 pounds, real big shoulders. He started out as a welterweight.
Yeah.
That's how long he boxed.
Yeah.
He boxed in Marcosuk, Frank. My father had him on the card. My father promoted fights in the 40s. And Walcott was on the card as a young boy fighting at 147 pounds. Mm-hmm. Going back a long way, man. So
did they do that
been?
The down there off Penn Street? No. What was
on
it? Flower Street, right?
They call it Penn Street, Marcus Street.
Yeah.
In Marcosuk.
Right.
Right by what they built a library and a police station there. It used to be a fight arena there. And that's where he first appeared. Bob Montgomery, the lightweight champion of the world, fought there. I'm going way back with you guys. This is around Bojack's time, and before Ike Williams. And Marcosuk was a great little fight town because Leaperville, where everybody trained and was fighting in New York, would go to Leaperville. It was like going to the Poconos in those days. And they would do the rope. Jack Dempsey trained for all his fights there, most of his fights in Leaperville. Mm. And he used to come to Marcosuk to the turf club because they went to the track every day. Those guys, he would do road work, go to track, you know, work out, then go to the track with the group of gamblers from Hook. And he had a beautiful, I didn't see him, but the other guys told me he had a beautiful camel hair coat with no buttons on it. And he used to just throw it over, you know, come to Hook with the shiniest shoes you could imagine and that camel hair coat, man, and he'd sign autographs for an hour. Everybody loved that guy. That's how far back, boxing goes in that town. But so what's going on? Who's fighting tonight?
Nothing major in the States. We just have a lot of fights in Europe tonight. Nothing major in the States this evening.
What, nothing major in the States?
Yeah,
when's Klitschko come to Philly?
What's that? April, what, 23rd, Butch?
I think that's when it is, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That could be off on a date, but it's somewhere around mid to late April, yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Chris, I wrote an article for Doghouse Boxing. It's called Old Time Fighter versus New Age Boxer. It's basically what the article says. What do you think about that? Who do you think that went, essentially?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you took a boxer from, let's say, maybe the 1950s, a welterweight from the 1950s, the average welterweight, and
40,
match them up
against
the average 40. Welterweight nowadays. Okay, 40, yeah.
Well, you got to have to remember, these welterweights now are bigger.
Yes.
They're going to be bigger. So you got a 5-pound weight advantage to, you know, or more. What are they entering the ring at now? If they weigh in at 47, what are they weigh in at? 54?
Yeah, maybe an average of 53, 54.
Yeah, like a junior middleweight. Well, what welterweight would you like? I mean, I saw them all from 40, I'd say 46 on.
Like, I made a comparison. It might not be a fair comparison, but I made a comparison between a Victor Ortiz and a Carmen Basilio in the article.
Well, you saw Carmen Basilio fight many times, I'm sure, especially when he fought Robinson. He fought Robinson at 154. That's all he weighed that night. He was a gnarly, muscled, iron head. He had a great left hook. He's the only man that ever floored Gavilan, who had an iron chin. Kid Gavilan, unfortunately, couldn't beat Robinson. It was that simple. He could not beat Robinson. Robinson was just fought forever as a welterweight and beat everybody in sight till he moved up to fight LaMotta. I don't think there's a welterweight around today that could beat Sugar Ray. I don't know anybody. I'm thinking Basilio, how tough he was. He would just come in to kill you. And, you know, had a tremendous left hook, take one hell of a punch. It was never on the floor. That would be interesting because he was a decent boxer. He knew how to bob and weave and go underneath. He was 5'6" and a half, and the welterweights were 5'9". They were tall as these guys are, 5'9", 5'10".
Yeah.
And he was always at a disadvantage in reach. And he was a bobber and weaver. And his first punch was always a body punch, a left hook to the body, and he threw kind of an overhand right, coming over the top with his right hand. He would be tough to beat. These guys that would fight him today would be, because he was relentless and well-conditioned. Let's take him. I'll give you a good match. Amir Khan and Basilio.
Basilio. Yeah, I don't think that would be a good match, to be honest. I really don't. Well,
you know,
I think Basilio will wear Amir Khan out.
That's what I think. In time, over 12 rounds, 15 rounds, Basilio would get him. Basilio used to go, he never had early knockouts. 12th, 13th round, 14th round. All his knockouts were in late rounds. He knocked beat Johnny Saxon 15-round decision. He knocked DeMarco out twice in the late round, like 13th or 14th. He's the only man I ever saw knock Gavilan down. He murdered a couple of West Coast welterweights, Art Aragon and a couple guys. I remember after the Art Aragon fight, he said, "Would you like to fight Basilio again?" He said, "Yeah, if they give me an axe." You know? He said, "I'm allowed to bring an axe in the ring, I'll fight you." You know? He said, "Got to be crazy." He said, "The man just killed me." He was laughing. He said, "The man just murdered me." So he was just a relentless, you know, fighter. He was voted the third most durable fighter in the first half of the century by the sports writers. He was voted the third most durable fighter of all times. LaMotta was ahead of him, and one guy was ahead of him, Joe Grimm. He was actually an Italian, but changed his name to Grimm because very long name. He fought Jack Johnson, who was the heavyweight champion of the world. He fought him at 150. He got knocked down 20-some times. And all of Philadelphia was betting that Jack Johnson couldn't knock him out. There was no bet on who would win. The bet was on what round and all the Italians in South Philly, which there was a million of them in those days, bet on him to stay the full course, and he did. He got voted number one. But Basilio, you know, I never saw the man down. I've seen him hit pretty hard. DeMarco hit him pretty hard. I'll give you another name. Kid Gavilan was one hell of a welterweight.
Yeah.
Like I say, couldn't get by. He was tall. He was very tall. And that bolo punch was just, they just threw that out there. But he was a damn good jabber and threw a good right hand. But he would do the bolo, would be a little show. You know, he would show off a little bit.
Right.
But he was a damn good welterweight. Let's see, you got to go back to the 30s. Jimmy McLaren, the Toy
Mickey
Bulldog,
Walker.
Mickey Walker, great welterweight. Mm-hmm. Great welterweight.
And middleweight.
He fought all the heavyweights of the day.
Yeah.
Nobody knocked him out. I mean, hell, the guy 5'7" fight Jack Sharkey, who weighs 210, 6'1.5". You know, I mean, he fought Dempsey. I don't know how middleweight would survive. You know,
and that's my take on a lot of it. Like nowadays, you have some advantages, but back then you also had advantages. These guys, I mean, they're heavier now. They can the weigh-ins are held a day before the fight, so now they're allowed to rehydrate. I think up until 1983, there was no rehydrate. The weigh-ins were held the day or the night of the fight.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my take is that back then these guys went 15, depending on the era, maybe 20 rounds. So their conditioning was tremendous. And to ask a guy back then to fight by the standards of now, they can adapt. But to ask a guy now to go and fight the standards back then, that they'll get killed. They'll get killed. They'll get mauled to death. They couldn't deal with it.
They couldn't deal with the roughhousing and the brawling.
Mm-mm.
Now,
mm-mm.
You know what? You got to go back. Let's go back a few years ago to the 80s.
Yeah.
Sugar Ray. Mm. He was a great welterweight. I think he bridged the gap pretty good, Sugar Ray. I think he bridged the gap from the 50s to the fought. He bridged.
Yeah.
I really was impressed with Sugar Ray Leonard. I'm talking about Leonard. I think he bridged the gap well, too.
I think that's a good way to put it. He did bridge the gap, I think.
Yeah.
He bridged
between
the gap.
Between the old fighter
he,
and the
he
minor
could fight.
Old
he could
fight.
He was in condition. He's one of the few guys. Here's my throwbacks. Here's who I Hagler could have fought in any era.
Any era.
I told that to LaMotta. He said, "I'll come out of here and kick your ass," he told me. I said, "Hey, Jake, I heard your comments about Hagler. He'd have given you all you wanted." I said, "He'd have boxed you silly." He said, "What? I'll come out here and kick your ass." He was in a booth. I said, "Look," he said, "I fought light heavyweights. I fought heavyweights." He said, "I fought the hardest. I know you knocked Bob Satterfield out. I know your record. I know it as well as you do." I said, "But Leonard would have gave you all. I mean, Hagler would have gave you all you wanted. And just like Duran could have fought in any era."
Yes.
Duran could have fought in any era. Mike Williams could have fought any era. But he was an old-timer. You'd have to consider him an old-timer. But not many of the guys from 1975 on could have fought, were as rugged, because those guys fought more often. They were in better condition. I mean, they were used to going 15 rounds.
Yes, sir.
15 rounds. I mean, that was brutal. 15 rounds was brutal.
Not only that, these guys, I mean, back then, it was almost mandatory as a boxer to be physically tough. I mean, it's hard to name anybody
right.
a champion back then that couldn't take a punch or absorb some amount of punishment. To where nowadays,
you can have a champion today. Yeah,
yeah,
that's true. You can have a champion who gets knocked out by a hard win.
And if you didn't fight and entertain the crowd, they'd boo you out of the arena. They would boo you to death. You know what I mean? If you fought like dance around, like Mayweather's a dull fighter in a lot of ways. He dances around, he plays around. They'd boo him out of the ring in the 50s. He wouldn't draw flies, you know. They wouldn't come to see him. They demanded that you try to please the crowd. That was an old term for guys like Basilio. He's a crowd pleaser, you know. Well, I think you're right. I think they were mentally tougher. They weren't spoiled. They didn't have money. They had to fight to stay alive. They were hungry, and I'm trying to as I'm talking, I'm trying to think of who could have fought in that era. I think when they look back 40, 50 years from now, they're going to say Sugar Ray could have Sugar Ray Robinson, Sugar Ray Leonard, and Tommy Hearns would have had the same problem he had with Leonard. As soon as you got to his body, he would be gone. You know, but he was a great fighter.
Great.
You know, he would have given you a hard time.
Hell of a puncher.
He was a hell of a puncher. I saw him in his first fight when he came to Philadelphia. he fought a little short guy named Alfonso Heyman. Alfonso Heyman fought the exact style that Tyson did. He held his hands exactly like Mike Tyson.
Okay.
So what did he was 5'6", 5'7". Hearns kept popping him in the forehead. Okay, finally both hands were so sore he couldn't fight anymore. It was the first time he went 10 rounds. He ever went 10 rounds? I went back to the dressing room with Marty Feldman, and I looked at his hands. They were puffed up like balloons. He couldn't wait to get the gloves off. His hands were so sore, you know. And had Alfonso Heyman been he was just there as an opponent. He wasn't there to win, you know. They wanted to show him off in Philly and break him into the New York, you know, Philadelphia area. They wanted to get an easy fight for him in Philly first. But, you know, he's pretty damn impressive when he fought Hagler. That was a hell of a fight. I mean, could have gone either way. You know, Hagler had an awful cut. But you had two determined guys there, and neither guy was going to give in an inch. They were going to kill one another. Toughest man goes out first. I mean, the toughest guy wins. That was one of them fights where...
And that was the difference, you know, is that Hagler had all-time great toughness and one of the all-time great chins, and Tommy
didn't. Right, and that's the difference.
That was the difference.
The difference, and if you wrote an article, that's the difference, the toughness. You know, the toughest guy won that fight. I told you guys before, Sugar Ray won his first 69 fights.
Yeah.
69 fights. That's a lot of fights to win in a row. You know? I mean, and that was a tough year. That was right at the end of the war when everybody came back. They were, you know, everybody was broke and fighting anywhere. And boxing was at the height of its popularity.
And this is the time when you had to fight the best opponents. You couldn't pick and choose your opponents.
Willie Pep was 60-0 before he lost his first fight. And there were, you know, guys, you go back to the 30s and late 30s, very early 40s, there was a couple of Jewish welterweights that were terrific, beautiful boxers. One of them went in the Army and got wounded, and they used to give you a morphine kit to take with you in case you got wounded. And you'd give yourself, you know, two or three shots. Then your buddies would give you two. By the time you got back to first aid, Christ, you're literally a drug addict, you know? And I'm trying to think of the one guy who was sensational. Boy, I can see him boxing now. See, in those days, when you had the Friday night fights, and if there was a knockout in the first or second round, they would throw the old fights on. Billy Papke. You go back and you see guys like Stanley Ketchel, who was as tough as nails.
Yeah, he was rugged.
Hard. Tough. Oh, afraid of nobody. A wild man. Just a killer. You know, just a... He only lost one fight to a guy named Billy Papke. He used to come in the ring with an Indian blanket wrapped around him, and everybody would yell like an Indian, you know, and he'd dance around. He was one of those guys, you needed a baseball bat. You had him with a baseball bat to get his attention, you know? And when him and Ketchel was a bloodbath, he beat Ketchel once, then Ketchel got him the second time. But Stanley Ketchel, you know, you got to go with the great ones. You got to go with Ketchel, and then you got Harry Greb.
Harry Greb.
One of my father's favorite fighters who beat
People consider him the best middleweight of all time.
Yeah, well, you know what? He fought the bigger guys. He was the only guy that ever beat Jack Dempsey.
Gene Tunney, yeah. Yeah, he's the only guy to beat Tunney.
Yeah, Gene Tunney. He gave Tunney a shellacking. You know, Tunney never won, and you know, and half the time, most of his career, he was blind in one eye.
Yes.
Him and Mickey Walker went at it. Greb got the decision. That was one of the all-time great middleweight fights. And they don't have
from Pittsburgh, right? Am I right? He's from Pittsburgh?
Harry Greb is Pittsburgh, yeah, along with
Pittsburgh
Fritzy
windmill,
Zivic.
Right?
Fritzy Zivic.
Fritzy Zivic, yeah.
They were Pittsburgh was a hotbed for boxing.
Yeah,
a lot of good fighters. They had a lot of good fighters, but Harry Graves probably the greatest fighter ever to come out of that area. But like I say, I saw Greb on film. I never saw him live. I mean, he was before my time. But if you're bridging a gap, I go with Duran in any era. I'll go with Hagler in any era. You know, but you know, I wouldn't. You know, Hearns could fight. He would give you a tough time, but he wouldn't last. He wouldn't last against a guy like Greb.
Dr. Chris, would you consider anybody during this era that can go to fight in any other era?
You know what? I'm learning to appreciate Golovkin. If he keeps going the way he is, I'm going to have to say he could go back to any era, because nobody has tested his chin out real good, but I think he's pretty tough. I think he'd be the only guy that would. I wouldn't say Mayweather would fight in that era.
Mm-mm.
If Mayweather had to fight like those guys did 6-7 times a year, 8 times a year, I think he'd be gone. He wouldn't hold up. He wouldn't. He gets himself so many easy fights. You know, I wouldn't, Sugar Ray, I'd say yeah. I wouldn't go with Mayweather.
What about a guy like Julio Cesar Chavez, Senior?
There's the other guy I forgot.
Ah,
you know,
okay.
That's the other guy I forgot. He did one thing I didn't like that he wouldn't have got away with in the 30s and 40s. He stood up, straight up.
Yeah.
He never dipped his legs. When he threw the left hook to the body, he always dropped it and threw it. He was very vulnerable to counter right hands.
That's how he got shot down.
That's
how Frankie Randall put him down.
Knocked the hell out. I said it many times. As soon as somebody comes along with a good right hand and is willing to stand there and trade punches with him and not worry about getting hit in the liver, somebody's going to knock him down.
That happened when he was older also.
Yeah, yeah. When he lost it. What's for call? You know what? I knew he was getting old when the kid from Philly, Meldrick Taylor. Meldrick Taylor beat him. So did Pernell Whitaker.
Yeah.
Pernell beat him. That anybody watches that fight, 1,000 people, good, you know, boxing people look at that fight. Nobody would vote give that fight to Chavez. He lost that fight. You know,
Do you think Pernell Whitaker could have fought in any era?
He's a pretty damn good boxer.
He was, though, man.
He'd drive you crazy to fight him. you know, he would drive you nuts. You know,
and he was
there
tough,
was a,
too.
A great
he was
a
tough,
great,
too,
oh, yeah, there was a great Jewish lightweight. He was voted the best lightweight. One of the best lightweights of all time is Benny Leonard.
He fought
just like he had a similar style in and out, great right hand, but he was like Pernell Whitaker. And I was sitting there thinking when I used to watch Pernell Whitaker fight, this guy's way, way ahead of this generation that he's in. And I was thinking back to who the hell, you know, it would have taken a guy like Ike Williams or somebody like that to beat him. So I think he would have been, you know, right up there, you know, because he could box. God, anytime a kid could box that good, he'd give everybody fits, you know.
And he was tough.
Yeah, he took a shot pretty good. I mean, I never saw him.
Wasn't afraid
you know,
to come forward and bang with you, and wasn't afraid to fight you on the inside if had to. Yeah.
I love to watch Pernell Whitaker fight. You know, sometimes I never had a dull moment watching Pernell Whitaker. I really thought a lot of him.
Very entertaining.
I mean, you know, if you go back to the great lightweights, Ike Williams was probably the best of the post-war lightweights. And I think Pernell Whitaker would have gave him a good fight. I don't know if he'd have won or not, because Ike Williams really hit hard. Jesus, did he hit hard. You know, he knocked out the first time I saw him, I got my TV like that afternoon, and I turned it on that night. Who's fighting but Bojack and Ike Williams? My father's favorite fighter was Bojack, and I liked Ike Williams. And I'm rooting for him. My father's saying, Bojack's going to beat him, and it didn't happen. And then my dad said, Bojack's had 100 fights, and the war interrupted his career. My father had good reasoning why he lost, but I would love to have seen those two fight 5 years prior, you know, in their prime. You know what's funny about fighters? I have books on everybody that ever wrote a book about themselves. Jack Johnson, Dempsey.
Oh, okay.
Every one of them says, these guys around today couldn't hold a candle to the guys that were fighting when I came up. I heard Jack Johnson say that. He said, Chuinsky would have knocked all these clowns out. You know, he fought Chuinsky on a barge when he was a young man, and Chuinsky was a rough, tough, you know, fighter and bare-knuckle type guy. They wore 4-ounce gloves. That's all he wore, nothing more than a piece of leather over your hand. And it's funny how all the fighters say they wouldn't have, these guys that are around today couldn't fight in my era when I was coming up. And it seems like history repeats itself. They keep saying it, you know. I've heard Sugar Ray say the same thing. But he's nice about it. Sugar Ray but he said, these guys would have had a tough time in my era.
Yeah.
He died kind of early, Sugar Ray. And Walcott, there were a lot of guys that thought Walcott and Marciano would have gave Dempsey a hell of a fight, you know. Both of them, you know, the great sports writer that covered the Marciano-Joe Louis fight said, you know, I'm sitting here watching Marciano. He would have given Jack Dempsey a hell of a fight, you know. How do you figure that out? Well, Dempsey came at you like a crazy man, you know. And you know, he went to Hollywood after he won the title, after he beat Willard. He stayed in Hollywood 5 years.
Yeah, he didn't spend the title for like 5 years, right? 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, he goes there, and he was going to the track every day. He had 100 girlfriends, and he never fought. And you know, when he fought Tunney, he was a shadow of himself, a shadow of what he once was. You know, you can't stay away 4 or 5 years.
No.
In the Depression era, the people had a saying, the wrinkles are out. And what they meant was, you know, when things were tough and you had the Depression, everybody's ribs were showing. You know, they were so skinny from not eating. And an expression that came around the country, the wrinkles, when you get a little weight, they would cover the ribs, you know, and that was an expression to mean that now they're enjoying the good times, they're not as good as they once were. And that was the expression they used about Dempsey. He's not the same fighter, you know, he's been living a high life. So the lighter weights were the same way, except for guys like Greb. They fought 150, 175 times. That's a lot of fights. You know? I got a ring book home from 1939, and the guys fought 6-7 times a month, twice a week.
Wow.
What the hell was that? How the hell you got to have a bruised face? You got to go. You're walking around with a sore nose and black eyes forever.
And that, that brings up another point, because these guys had to fight back-to-back almost. They didn't have time to sit there and them and their trainers go over the styles of their opponent, you know, maybe some of the habits, you know, of their opponent. These guys had to be watching tapes.
Yeah.
It was the first time they ever saw the guy.
Yeah, so they had to be highly adaptable.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, they had to be tough because, you know, they're until they adjusted to the guy, they're going to get wrapped. My father lived on 9th and Christian in Philly, and the Olympic Club was right down the street. And that was one of the most popular arenas in the country. and he saw all the early champions, back to Johnny Cobain, Benny. He saw all of them. My father saw all the fighters, and I can only, you know, tell you what he told me. He said Benny Leonard would fight 10 rounds and his hair wouldn't get messed up. He'd still have the same part. You know, Johnny Cobain was a deadly puncher, and he was going on and on. And it's very interesting. I hope someday I see you guys. I'll give you my books to read. You see how many times these guys fought. You wouldn't believe it. Well, they accumulate 150, 160 fights.
Yeah.
Now, you couldn't fight twice a year unless you fight when you're 90, you know? You know, LaMotta had 150 fights, and he got his face punched in every one of them. Because he was never that good. A boxer was short in stature, and he didn't have long arms. The only way he could win was to take a, you know, get in there and get mixed up with you. I mean, I saw him fight plenty of times, and it would be touch or go till he finally got you with that left hook to the body, you know. Like he fought Marcel Cerdan. It was the last.
Oh yeah.
One of the last films in black and white, and he just mauled Cerdan. You know, Cerdan was a good fighter, and even Robinson didn't want to move up to the middleweight division and fight him. LaMotta killed him, roughhouse him, threw him around a ring like a rag doll, mauled him, and then he quit. He said his shoulder hurt. His shoulder hurt hell. His ribs hurt. His head hurt. And his, you know, he got the hell beat out of him. That's LaMotta. You know, he would try to tie LaMotta up, but LaMotta would just break the, lift him up, look like he was going to throw him out of the ring. He mauled him, you know. And Cerdan was a good fighter. Damn good fighter.
Great right hand.
He had a classic style. He had his left shoulder forward. His chin was tucked in behind his left shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an open hand in front. And he had that right hand cock. He had a full, like a 90-degree shoulder turn when he fought. And he was hard to hit. And when he let that right hand go, he would sling that damn thing at you. Man, he could pop you with it, you know. He could really hit. But LaMotta, I mean, he did it to LaMotta, boom, boom. And it was like hitting nothing. LaMotta just took the shot and came back, you know. And then when he realized he can't hurt this guy, I think it took the starch out of him. I don't think he had the guts to go any further, you know. That's what, you know, of that fight. So I'm just trying to think back to the 20s, who was around in the 20s.
Have you seen a film of Joe Gans?
Joe Gans.
Nobody has. There's no fight films of Joe Gans. There's a few of Jim Corbett, and if you saw the fight films from that era, they looked awkward because it looked like everybody was jumping and was fighting straight up in the air. I saw Corbett fight, and I thought, oh, my God, he would get killed today, you know? And I had to laugh because they had four or five of the fighters. While they were showing this film, they said, Christ, Willie Pep would be the heavyweight champion of the world if he fought him, you know? These guys would come in with – they were brawlers. They didn't know if they were going to fight one round or 70 rounds.
Wow.
You know, and they weren't really boxers. They were just brawlers, pure out brawlers. Jack Johnson wasn't that way. Jack Johnson was a great boxer, great defensive fighter.
What about Bob Foster? Not Bob Foster, Bob Fitzsimmons.
Who?
Bob Fitzsimmons.
He only weighed 167 pounds. He was a big, like a raw bone guy that didn't weigh 170. And he had a tremendous body puncher. And he caught Corbett at the end of his career and knocked him out. But Jeffries gave him a shellacking. A lot of fighters, you know, beat him. He came along at the right time, but then when the bigger heavyweights got a hold of him, he couldn't stand up to him. But he was very skinny. had big bony shoulders, long arms, skinny legs. You know, a freakish looking guy. Freakish looking guy. You know, funny looking son of a bitch. You know, 167 pounds. He's fighting. He's fighting Jim Jeffries, who weighed 220. It looked like man against boy in there, and then punches were bouncing off Jeffrey like they were bouncing off a brick wall, you know. But he did knock Corbett out.
Corbett.
You know what? I don't know if they ever saved those films. I don't know if they look clumsy because the films were. The things didn't flow together. They were the way they recorded things. It made them look clumsy. Made them look awkward. And they didn't look very impressive. I saw Jim Jeffries on Corbett. But then in the 20s, all those fights. There's pictures of all those fights. I mean, you could see. They've got films of all those guys. The guy from New York kept them and made a fortune selling them for greatest fights of the century. Not Fleshman. He was the editor of Ring. The other guy.
Bill Caden?
Was it Bill Caden who did that or Jimmy Jacobs?
Jacobs. Jacobs.
Jimmy Jacobs, yeah. It was Jimmy Jacobs.
Jimmy Jacobs. Jimmy Jacobs made a lot of money on those. Like I say, when TV came out, he sold all the rights to all those things because they would run them on when it was an early knockout. You know, you didn't have nothing on television. They'd put greatest fights of the century. That's when I saw Dempsey Willard. That's when I saw Billy Papke fight. I saw Tony Canzonieri. Now, there was a great fighter. He was featherweight, lightweight, and welterweight champion. He won all three titles. He was 5'6". 5'6". That's all he was. But what a great fighter, good puncher. He was tremendous. Henry Armstrong. I mean, I had a friend that actually fought him. Al Tribbiani fought Henry Armstrong before the war.
Yeah.
So anyway, Henry Armstrong fought him, and. Al was laying down on his table there waiting for the fight, and his brother Ralph says, Al, relax a little bit. I got to go out and see somebody out in the hall. And Al says, where are you going? He says, never mind. You lay down here. I'm going. He says, I opened the door and peeked out. He was making a bet against me. He was betting on Armstrong. That son of a bitch. My own brother was betting on Armstrong, you know. Oh, funny. He'd make you laugh. Old fighters were funny. They were funny. You know how bad I felt when my own brother's betting against me? Oh, Christ. But Henry Armstrong would wear you out. I mean, just stay right on you. And he wore those guys out. They were in great condition. I mean, he wore them down. I mean, he fought all the way up to the middleweight division. He fought Gorilla Jones at 154. And a guy from our neighborhood, Billy Angelo, he fought them all. And he told me a lot of stories. He fought Benny Leonard during his comeback era. Leonard grew into a welterweight. And he fought Benny Leonard, and he fought in that era. He married a girl from our neighborhood and then moved down there in Marcus Hook. So he was a tough-looking guy. Oh, my God, was he tough. You know, he looked like a fighter, you know? He looked like a fighter. Christ, that's all I could tell you about him. He came in a gym one day when he was about 55 years old, and Freddie Sammons, all these guys were fought in the 40s and 50s, and they said he hit the speed bag so bad, he thought so hard, he thought he was going to knock it off the damn wall. He said, I was waiting for that thing to fall on his head any minute. He hit the speed back so hard. He said, it was unbelievable. So, you know, they talk in all the guys that fought 20 years before them. Billy Angelo fought. He did fight Gorilla Jones for the title, and he lost that, but he was up there pretty far. You know, we're talking about old-timers They were exciting. Boxing was the number one sport. You had no pro football. Boxing was number one. Boxing and college football, and it was in the limelight. And the boxing reporters were comedians. They were so damn funny. You couldn't wait to read their articles. I remember when LaMotta won the title, and then when he outgrew the middleweight division, he fought as a light heavyweight. But he wasn't interested in fighting as a light heavyweight. Just did it for the money. So Bob Murphy was a good puncher. Gave him a beating. He didn't knock him down, but gave him a good beating. And Dan Parker, the number one boxing columnist in the country, the next day in the paper, he goes, "You know Wada? LaMotta no gala." You know? Speaking in broken, "You know Wada? LaMotta no gala." Well, that was hysterical. Wow. That was on, you know, everybody was laughing. "You know Wada? LaMotta no gala." I still laugh when I read that. But that's what you see in the paper the next day. The guys were comedians. They were very funny. Boxing people were hysterically funny. Oh, it was fun to be around them as a young man. They were just funny. But like I say, you know, those guys were tough. They were tough. There was a good lightweight from Philly named Lou Massey. Lou Massey had 137 fights. So I got his record. He fought every 4 or 5 days. He's fighting Baltimore on Tuesday, Philly on Saturday. What's going on? He's fighting 8-rounders, you know, 6 8-rounders. And then when the money was big, they had to fight 10. But, you know, they just, everybody went to the fights in those days. You know, it was an era when Philadelphia had 5 or 6 arenas. But Philadelphia, when I was a young man in the teens, they had 5 or 6 arenas. You could go see 1 or 4 or 5 fights. They'd have them at the arena, the bigger fights at the arena. They had Toppy Stadium down in South Philadelphia. They had the Cambria all year round. They had fights. And you had some outdoor stadiums right here and there. At Wilmington. Wilmington used to. Ralph Tribbiani had fights at Wilmington once a month. Good pro fights, too. I saw Rocky Graziano fight in Wilmington. My dad took me. I was a little boy. My dad took me. He knew I was my hero, Rocky Graziano. And he took me down to Wilmington. Had about 15,000 people there, 20,000 people there. It was a big football stadium. I was a thrill.
The old Blue Rock
he
Stadium.
Fought there.
Yeah,
he was getting ready to fight a comeback against Zale. And Zale, there's a good middleweight, rough, tough guy. Tony Zale, Jesus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, around that era when Zale was fighting, before the war, Billy Kahn was a middleweight. Freddie Apostoli was a middleweight. They had a lot of big, tall fighters, a lot of 6-foot middleweights in that era. Those guys, there was a lot of great middleweights around. And then the war grabbed them all up and killed boxing for about 8-10 years before they could build up good fighters again because all the fights disappeared. There was a gap, in the late 40s where nothing but the old-timers and the new kids coming up. And then, of course, you know, Friday night fights were televised. That brought boxing right back. So I'd like to read your article. How was it received?
I think it was very good. It's posted on Doghouse Boxing.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent article.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go right on Doghouse Boxing. I really want you to read it.
Okay. I'll get somebody who knows how to do a computer, use a computer, and I'll read it. You guys have a lot of, you know what, somehow we got to get together. I'm going to give you all the literature I got on the old fighters and all the old books and all. You'd love to read them. I got ring record books back as far as 39. And I had a lot of ring. I saved all the great ring magazines, and my buddy wanted to read them, and he never gave them back to me. And now I don't even know. He don't even know where. He says he don't know where they're at. I know what he did. It was like the ring with a picture of Marciano on the front right after he won the title, with Graziano on the front, Sugar Ray. I got all the, you know, the great would be classic ring magazines, and I bought them off a guy. Some of them I saved, a lot of them I bought. They know I bought things like that. And they're gone now. I really am mad at that guy for I know what he did. He sold the damn things. I know that's the kind of guy he is, you know. But I still got enough left over. You'd like to read them. Because I still read them. I get a kick out. You know, even Tex Cobb, when he comes here, he reads them. He looks at them. He reads them. And we had many a discussion on the size of the heavyweights today and the size of those guys. And like I said, it was a crime to lift up a barbell or do a push-up. They would use the term muscle down in those days. Would let anybody work out and get stronger. Or like Joe Louis could have carried 225 easy if he had worked out and done some push-ups and was allowed to do some gym work. So, and those guys would have been killers at 225. Killers. Dempsey was a big man. I saw him well after at his restaurant in New York, well after he lost the title. He's a big guy. He was about 6'1.5".
Yeah.
He was skinny when he fought, but, you know, they were. Dempsey would jump on a train in Colorado and come to Philadelphia or New York for a fight for $150, then jump on the train. They call him the hobo. The hobos all rode the trains, you know. But can you imagine that, getting on a train in Colorado with no food, no money in your pocket? He worked in the mines out there. Then come east, fight, then come back. He said, I only turned down one fight in my life, against Sam Langford.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He said, I don't want any parts of Sam Langford. He said, Jack Johnson didn't want to fight him. Nobody wanted to fight him. Why should I fight him? He said, I only weighed 165 pounds. He said, I want no parts of Sam Langford. The hell with it. He said, I'm going to come east, ride a train all this way, freeze to death. But what I'm getting at is that's how tough people were. There was no money anywhere, no money, no way to make any money. So, you know, if you fought 2, 3, 4 times a month, you did it for the money.
Yeah.
And you didn't worry about, you know, getting your face banged up and all that. But can you imagine jumping on a train in Colorado and come east to fight and not train at all? Have no money for sparring and then get ready for a fight? What the hell? That was a different animal, you know? You can't have the conditions today to make these guys as tough as they were, because they're just softer.
You can't duplicate the history. You can't duplicate society. Society built things, man.
Yeah. I got Jack Dempsey's life story here. It's a very good book to read. You know, it was a brutal book to read. I mean, you know, Jesus Christ. You know, who's tough enough to do what he did, you know? You know, and like I say, these guys are pampered today.
Yeah.
You know what irritates me a lot? They're not really interested pleasing the crowd, and they don't fight for the crowd now. They fight for themselves. They don't take any chances. I saw a guy this week who took no chances.
Oh.
No chance. He was tough. And then some clumsy 6'3" guy at 154 pounds in the last round knocked him down twice. The guy named, like, his name was like Nunez. This guy just touched punts, moved around. He was winning the decision, but he had no intentions of knocking anybody out. He just was in there not to get touched, not to get hurt. And I, like I told Frank, when I saw Keith fight against that guy that night, I didn't like that fight. When he fought that left-handed guy, I didn't like that fight. I think if Keith keeps doing that and keeps letting the guy in the ring, something's going to happen. I don't think he'll ever be a popular fighter until he, you know, takes the guy out. Like, that guy should have never gone at 12 rounds with him, never. You know who I'm talking about, that little left-hander he fought?
The last fight he had.
Okay. Yeah, did you like that fight?
Bundu, against Bundu.
Yeah.
He was counter-punching.
Yeah. It looked like he was working on being a little more patient, using his feet.
He was trying to establish
more outside presence.
Yeah, and you know, not. But he wasn't aggressive. I mean, I didn't like that fight, and I think if that's going to be his attitude from here on out, he's never going to attain the popularity that he should. I mean, they're trying to promote him now on television here. I saw,
yeah.
you know, they,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of little things, you know, shows. He's in a main header now, you know. But he's never going to capture the heart of the boxing world if he fights like that, you know. Can you imagine Mike Tyson dancing around and trying to win by decision?
You know what
I'm getting at? Mike Tyson's going to blow you the hell out of that ring as fast as he can get you out of there. You know, the only time I ever saw Tyson coast was against that real big heavyweight.
Razor Ruddock, maybe.
Yeah, even before that, man, that guy was big and tough. Early in his career, maybe his 18th, 19th fight. Tony Tucker?
I thought it was who you're talking about, Tony Tucker, yeah. Yeah.
He's a big guy, a big, tough guy. That's the only time I saw Tyson coast a little bit.
Tucker was a talented guy, too. He was an underachiever.
Oh, my God. I thought he was going to – he looked like he could be the heavyweight champion of the world. I was watching Tyson. He got Tyson's respect real early and real quick, and Tyson didn't do anything. He wasn't – and then I said, you know what? Mike's smarter than he looks. You know, why should go attack that big guy and get his ass kicked? You know.
Yeah, I think Tony hit him with a solid uppercut or something, and I remember that fight. Yeah, Tyson played it smart. He did.
Played it smart.
Tony Tucker was a big, tough guy. He just didn't have heart.
He's big and he could fight. And he could box. He could punch. I mean, he was impressive. That fight. That's when I realized, you know, if Tyson can really handle a guy like this and fight and win. I said he's going to continue on, and then he did. He got better and better and better. It's a shame what Don King did to him. It's a shame. It's a shame that because he would have gone down as one. Well, he's going to go down as one of the all time greats anyway. But he was mishandled. He was mishandled. You know, when he went to jail, he gave
up against our time limit here. Chris, was a fantastic show, thanks to you and the boys here.
Well, we'll find out when you get the ratings, Frank.
I'm already looking at them.
I mean, we're impressed with ourselves. We got to hear what the rest of the world thinks. We're over here shooting a bull, you know. Guys, I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Dr.
I'm going to give you all my books. If you're going to write articles and do things, I'm going to give you everything I got, and you'll enjoy it. You'll there's some things there that nobody's left. You know, I had a patient died at 93, and he gave me some old books. And I said, how long have you had these? Since I was a kid. He said, when I was a teenager. Jesus Christ. You know. He had fighters on the line. Anybody that was local, he had everybody on the line, you know. I talked to him all the time. But you saw this guy fight. You saw that. I'm like you. I'm saying, did you see so and so? Oh yeah, I saw him in person here in Philly. You know, it's funny to hear somebody saw a guy live in the 20s. You know, nobody around today. You know. Ralph Rose, he was a great fight fan, and he gave me a lot of books. And he was 90, he almost made 100. He died when he was about 98 years old, and boy, he could tell you stories. I couldn't write them down. I should have gave him a, you know, let him just give him a microphone or something or somewhat of a speaker somehow. I didn't know how to use him at the time, but it was a treasure listening to that guy. You know, so anyway, we'll meet someday, guys. You know,
definitely.
We'll just ship them to Frank. To you, Frank will get them to you.
Yes, sir.
All right, take it easy,
okay.
Guys.
Thanks, Chris.
Bye, Dr. Chris.
Dr. Chris.
All right, bye.
All right. Well, our Far West correspondent has joined us. Frankie, you want to take us out? I guess he's contemplating it. Z, you want to take us out?
No, you had the mic off.
Oh, there you go.
Yes, he's there contemplating
you. There you go.
Hey, Frankie.
How you guys
doing, Frankie?
Hey, Frank, how you doing, brother?
Good. Good. You know, it's always amazing listening to Chris and just the wealth of knowledge that that guy has.
Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you, I was standing next to him when he had the confrontation with LaMotta. And LaMotta got pissed. And Chris just stood there toe-to-toe and took him down by words. It was something to behold.
He's irascible.
He has met a lot of people. He knows a lot of people.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. Great guy.
Yeah.
Frankie, you want to take it
guys, down? Yeah, again, thanks so much for keeping the show alive. It's been many years now the show's been going, and, you know, it's always been great discussions about boxing, and Pacquiao's always mentioned at least once in the show, so... You know,
yeah.
Get that.
Well, yeah, he hadn't but. Been until today, until just now. So,
yeah, I don't know about that whole fight. I think that Pacquiao's just making a money grab at this point. I mean, Mayweather, I think, is going to beat him walking away, unless Mayweather gets, call it hubris or whatever you want to call it. You know, if he gets cocky and ends up getting
complacent.
Beat. Yeah, if he gets complacent, yeah, it's you know, he could end up getting his ass whipped there, but I don't think so. I think Pacquiao's going to get beat five rounds in. But again, really thanks so much, guys, for doing the show. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Frankie.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Z?
Well, this has been another wonderful show. I want to thank Dr. Chris. Love his boxing nostalgia, and we definitely need to meet him. Thank you, Frankie, and I want to definitely thank you guys. These shows are definitely in memory of Bob, and if anyone wants to hear any fighting words, please do call. Todd?
Z, tell us one more time what's your article, everybody can take a look at it.
My article is called Old Age Fighter, or Old Time Fighter, versus New Age Boxer. And it is on doghouseboxing.com.
Great. Ty?
Hey, it's been a great show, Z. That's a wonderful article. Actually, it was probably one of the best boxing articles I've read in the last few years. It was really excellent.
Thank you.
Very good breakdown. And I like the fact that you chose a side, too. You didn't just call it straight down the middle. You picked a side, but you validated both sides. So it was an excellent article. It was great having, you know, hearing Frankie's voice. Great having Dr. Chris on. Bob Zerkopol. We'll see you guys next week.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody for coming in. I'll be talking to Chris later on today. I really appreciate everything each and every one of you do for us for the show. Just so everybody knows, Frankie was a little late getting on with us because he was setting up the shows. All the shows for the next two months, since we can't put it in for a year now. So I couldn't do it without his technical background. These programs are brought to you each and every week. Grateful appreciation to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women of police and fire services. When you're out there and you see somebody in a uniform, if you just give them a wink, a handshake, you don't have to do anything outlandish. You can introduce your children to them. It means a world of good to everybody in uniform. These programs are also dedicated to those who've lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Kurth, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcutt, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Patrolman David Crawford, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Arnolfo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Barbara Pell, Broward County Sheriff's Office, Chief Al Hogle, Longboat Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township, PA Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, MIT Officer Sean Collier, Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office. Deputy Jonathan Scott Pine, Orange County Sheriff's Office. Patrolman Robert Germain, Windermere, Florida Police Department. Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol. Lieutenant
Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department. Our newest entry, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department. Anybody in the St. Pete area, there's a giant Return to the 50s dance tonight downtown at 4th and 2nd Avenue to raise money for Charlie Condit's 6 children that he left and his wife. So if anybody can go, it'd be appreciative. We'll see you there. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the root, may the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields and the sun shine softly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the hollow of his hand. Good night.
Shema hezahilma sona shene voratfet akuig again maelma
Thank you.
miss you. Good night, Freddie. We love you.
Good night.